at Waterloo.
Oh, I see.
I'm going to be talking about a particular experimental model for quantum information processing, and many of you know quite a bit about this system, the trapped ion system, where our quantum bits are very well-defined individual atoms that remain in place all day and so forth. And as you can guess by my dim-witted question for John this morning, I tend to simplify my thoughts of initialization and measurements the same thing. We have near-perfect measurement of our quantum bits, and again, they don't leave the apparatus. So it's an interesting system, but it's a small system. And so everything comes with a trade-off. And I want to talk a little bit about how to build on the great progress in this field over the last 10 years, how we hope to scale the system up. And because this is a fault-tolerant workshop, I want to really emphasize the errors that occur, not only in the conventional models, but as you attempt to build up the bigger devices. And it's going to touch on a lot of areas that pretty much everybody in this room knows a lot more than I do about. So bear with me and if I present major blunders. Okay. So a little background in atomic physics. You don't really need much, except to note that certain levels, energy levels in atoms are useful for quantum storage of quantum bit and also measurement of quantum bits. So in terms of storage, typically atomic qubits have two forms. And they're defined as simply the energy gap between the two states of sort of qubit. This is so-called optical qubit, because the energy level splittings are in the optical domain. Very difficult to deal with, because we don't really have oscillators that go this fast that are under great control. They do exist, but they're not in everybody's laboratory. I would say a little more useful, and pretty much the whole community is turning to this type of a quantum bit, which is the so-called microwave quantum bit. And these are actually real spin states in the ground state of the atom. They're actually coupled states of electron and nuclear spin, hyperfine levels. Very similar to what you find in nuclear magnetic resonance, although this also involves electron spin. And as I said, they're separated by typically microwave energies, where we have great control of that type of radiation. And although I read a coherent interaction here involving lasers, these lasers are both strongly detuned from an excited state, and their beat note is under great control. With modulating, again, so we have great control of controlling coherence in that system. This P state, though, is useful for resonance interaction to measure the quantum bit. I'm not going to talk too much about that. But we have lasers when we couple, say, a laser that is that matches the energy difference between this state and the P state exactly. It emits a lot of light, even though there's one atom. We can get billions of photons per second off that atom, and even if we only detect a few tenths of a percent of that, that's still a big signal. And we can get, in one shot, we can show that this state is bright and this state is dark, because this state is 10 to 10 hertz away from that state. So the measurement's there, the coherence is there. And with that, we can make gates. And it doesn't follow that we can make gates. We need something else. And I'm going to get to that in a minute. But let me dig deeper into the atomic system. It turns out that the simplest atom, in fact, probably the best type of atom, is one that has a spin 1/2 nucleus and spin 1/2 electron, just like hydrogen, just like an electron and a proton. And there are four states of net spin. They're coupled by hyperfine interactions, so you have a triplet, three levels here, and then the singlet, separated by this microwave I mentioned before. Now, these two states are special because they have their projection along the magnetic field is zero. So they have no Zeeman shift to first order. These are sometimes called clock states, because they're exactly the states that are used for atomic frequency standards. And if you try to make an atomic clock out of, say, these two states, you get laughed out of town. To have an atomic clock card, you have to be able to look at these states. And you can see here that if you have magnetic field noise, again, this is Z noise, if you want, and as mentioned before, that's much more pernicious than X noise, spin flip noise. If you have phase damping noise here, due to a magnetic field, you can see it's not so sensitive. So if you have very ambient magnetic field fluctuations, they still don't bother that type of quantum bit over good time scales. Whereas this guy here, in this state, the electron and nuclear spin are paired up in the same direction, so they're very sensitive to background magnetic fields, megahertz per Gauss type level. So that's why you can't really do much. It's very difficult to do coherent type experiment on that type of a pair. So you might call this, it's not error correction, it's doing the experiment right. And you're going to see a lot of that in the first several minutes of the talk, on how you want to get your system right so you can just, you can call it passive error correction if you want. Just to make, it's really straining to make. Okay, so most of you know that the progress in the last several years of trapped ions has been furious. On the other hand, these are pretty small numbers. So these are just basically flexing muscles and showing that you can do arbitrary manipulation with a few qubits, and you can call it Grover's algorithm. You can call it whatever you want, but it's a bunch of gates that are put together in a phase coherent way. And this is, again, I'm as guilty as everybody else. So this is from our laboratory, where it looks like an NMR block diagram. We're just manipulating the spin states of two ions. And in fact, this is a scalable circuit. It's hard to show it's scalable with only four states or two ions. But the oracle, that is the one that encodes which state is marked in the database, has this one XX gate that we can implement. And the readout in the Bell basis also has another one. And again, I just draw this to say that you do need pretty good control of phases. But this is nothing new. You know something about NMR, which is a very old technology. The thing that is new are these green gates that give you entangled states and so forth. And so this is how we mark the oracle, just individual rotation. That's what the R means. So I want to talk about how we might hope to scale this up in the future. And there are several approaches to scaling atomic quantum information processors. With ions, it's natural to consider entanglement through the Coulomb interaction. I haven't talked about it at all. I'm going to for a minute, but I'm not going to talk about it much after that. The Coulomb interaction, of course, because they're charged, there are shared degrees of freedom of motion. And whenever I think of several ions in a single chain, I think of a bunch of pendulums connected by springs. They have collective modes of motion, and those are also quantum systems. Through laser cooling, we can prepare the ground state. This is a highly classical state. The separation of these two ions is a couple of microns, maybe 3 microns, and it was excited with a huge classical driving force. There's nothing quantum at all about that picture there. But in the end, when we laser cool, we can actually prepare that, say, this breathing mode of oscillation in the quantum ground state. And then we can add one vibration to that degree of freedom, and you can't see it. The vibration takes place over a few nanometers, so you can't really image that, but it's there. And of these different ways, and this maybe isn't exhaustive, but it's what people are working on right now. These different ways of putting qubits together involve different length scales. As I mentioned, this 10^6 meter length scale for the Coulomb interaction. You could, in principle, have two ions that are a meter apart. They still have a Coulomb interaction, but it's so weak that you'd never be able to take advantage of it. So in practice, when ions are real close together, you take advantage of that type of interaction. It has its own type of errors, and I'll talk about that. This middle guy is over a millimeter length scale, and it's not really quantum at all. It involves classically picking up charges and moving them around. And it could probably be more than a millimeter, but this is what's been done so far. And the idea here is, once you've entangled based on the Coulomb interaction, you can peel these atoms off and move them around. I'll talk a little bit about that and the errors that we have to be mindful of that will arise because of the need to do that. I want to spend most of the time about this last one, and that is to do truly remote operations. And naturally, instead of using phonons, we're going to use photons, which are of course, much, much easier to transmit over large systems. Okay, so many of you know the Serac-Zoller model for the ion-trapped quantum computer. It involves, this is the Coulomb interaction we're going to deal with here, and it involves having a string of ions. Each of them has a qubit up-down in the nuclear spin, if you want, the hyperfine levels. And if we want to entangle a pair in here, all we need to do is, it's difficult to do, but it's dead done with several ions, cool the system to the ground state. There it is. It's the ground state. It's not moving at all. Well, it actually is moving, but you can't see that residual movement. I guess it's hard to draw a quantum ground state. But what we're going to do is entangle a couple of these ions, and this can be done remotely between ions that are not near as neighbors, because we're going to involve the collective mode of motion. They all take part equally in that mode, so it's kind of a democratic type of gate structure. So we're going to zap one of these ions with a laser beam in such a way that it coherently maps the state of spin the quantum bit memory onto the state of motion. That's really hard to draw, but the idea is like this. You zap that guy, now that guy, its spin state is in a pure state, say spin down. But the superposition down plus up is now in a superposition of all these guys being at rest and moving. Now, you might argue that, well, you can't really make that kind of state. Well, you can, as long as the system's small enough. So this, we'll come back to this issue. It's awfully hard. It's not very, this, when the quantum information is in motion, it is susceptible to decoherence in a very much more strong way than when it was in the spin. Well, carrying along with the Sterrett-Zoller model, you do a very similar operation on another ion. You say flip that spin depending on the state of motion. It's a very similar laser interaction. Not hard to do. And then you reverse the first step. You take any, if there was any motion, it gets mapped back onto that spin. So now that spin is unaffected, and this spin was affected depending on the state of that spin. Indirectly through the phonon. Okay? That's the Sterrett-Zoller model. And you can do it on any pair, and therefore you can build arbitrary gates that way. And this is, of course, shown pretty much as soon as they heard about Peter Shor's algorithm, they put this together in 1995. And it's been the workhorse for these applications I showed before. Now, again, the problem is when you put that quantum information in motion, there's a lot of decoherence. And not surprising, we're talking about a charge. Charge couples to the environment very strongly. A spin doesn't so strongly. The spin is kind of protected. It needs a magnetic field. It's in higher order transition. But if you have any noisy electric fields, it will heat the ion and cause decoherence. And I'll say all measurements so far have been much worse measurements. We can actually do thermometry and measure the state of a single or a cloud of ions, just a string of ions. And they absorb energy from the environment at a rate that's much higher than what we expect. Well, we don't expect zero because the apparatus is at room temperature, and there are modes. The electric field, there is electric field out there from thermally radiating sources. But we can calculate that based on the geometry of the system, and we're still way above that. We don't really understand.
What about the phase scope? I mean, the instead you're just talking about changing the occupation number, right? What about the phase coherence time of?
Oh, well, this is when you're in the middle of this Sterrett-Zoller guy here, yeah. and you couple to a noisy electric field causing heating, it will do both phase and amplitude.
Okay. But is that number for just for one of those? Is it just for one?
That basically is T2. T1 is twice T2, I guess, in NMR language. But they both go roughly the same. One's twice the other, I guess. It's bad. You can't take advantage of an asymmetry in it. Yes?
Isn't that more like leakage noise here in this, or you wouldn't model it that way?
Leakage noise. So
leakage,
you're leaving.
Means then that you're not in a loud part of the.
You're leaving the subspace?
Yes. And
well, the problem is this is not really the qubit, it's only in transit of this gate. Where you ever have information that's susceptible. But you're right, once it leaks from that subspace, you're eventually going to map it back onto the spins and you're going to have errors.
Okay, but if you map it, you're going to have errors.
I like to think of just thinking about the Hilbert space of spins and it's not leakage.
Okay.
Now, there's a trick to get out of this. One of them, and again, this is under the classification of Cassidy aircraft, doing it right. Now, turns out these traps, I don't think I had pictures. Well, I have some pictures, but they're big. The electrodes are maybe millimeters or many hundreds of times the separation of the ion, so they're really far away. So these noisy electric fields are largely going to be uniform. Not the gradients are going to be really small. So they're really only going to couple to this mode of motion, the collective center of mass mode. This mode here is in pretty good shape. In fact, it's in roughly 10,000 times better shape than that one. So all the experiments I showed were done with this type of a mode, an internal mode. Okay, you can think of it as a decoherence-free subspace if you want. It just doesn't couple very strongly to the predominant source of noise. However, you still have a problem with heating, and I can, again, without going through too many details, the way you do this mapping from spin to motion, it's a laser force. You zap one of the ends of the laser. And that laser force is only as uniform as the electric field from the laser. And if this, so this is difficult to draw as well. If this is meant to mean that the center mass mode is now kind of noisy, but the stretch mode, it's like an EPR state or something. The stretch mode is a good situation. So if you're in this blue situation here, the distance is the same, or red, it's always the same, but you don't know what the center mass coordinate is. Okay? Now, in that case, this force that you're applying kind of washes out, and it's noisy. So you end up in a higher order, still coupling based on this heating. And this effect has limited most of the experiments I've talked about with the few lines, is heating. So we don't really understand it. And actually, I put this slide up because it's a neat idea that actually was inspired to me by Wojciech Zurich when we were mountain climbing in the Pyrenees, not just hiking on some of these high hills, like the Pyrenees mountains. And tells you, he really like hanging around with big theorists. He knew this issue, and he said, well, why don't you just say take an odd number of ions, say 3, and make the other two your logical quantum bits, and put a different species in the middle, or something that's not going to store quantum information, and just continuously cool it, keep it cold. Now, what you're doing there is you're quenching the center mass motion, which is fine, because you're not using it coherently, ever. You're only using the stretch mode, and the stretch mode has no component of motion with that middle ion. Really neat idea. It hasn't been implemented yet, but it's something we're going to be pulling out of our sleeves pretty soon, I think. The groups at NIST, our group to a certain extent also in Innsbruck, have been doing so-called sympathetic cooling, where you cool one ion and the other ones are cooled in sympathy. They're cooled based on the Coulomb interaction. And this is interesting, because it's a mode-dependent cooling. Again, it's just a clever way of doing things. Okay. Now, even better. Nobody takes this Zurich-Zoller model seriously anymore, because it involves cooling to the ground state. You have to have a pure state of motion. It turns out a much better way is now to more indirectly use the motion, that is to have a virtual coupling to the motion. And in practice, what that means is that all you need, you don't need a pure state of motion. You just need to be somewhat cold. And to give you a little bit of an idea there, what we're doing is applying spin-dependent forces. We're actually pushing the atoms around depending on their spin state. And again, I don't want to get too much atomic physics here, but the main idea is that in phase space, these single mode of motion is a harmonic oscillator, so in px space, it executes circular motion, I guess I'm the wrong way, like that. When you apply these laser spin-dependent forces, one spin state is going to execute in the rotating frame. We freeze the state of motion, whatever it is. One spin state executes some type of a trajectory and returns to where it started. The other spin state doesn't, or maybe goes the opposite way. And it turns out that you get a phase, a spin-dependent phase, depending on that area. Those are called phase gates. They're called a variety of names. It turns out, I still think the Zurich-Zoller idea is the basis for all this. This is just a refined version of it. It doesn't depend on the emotional state. You can see, it doesn't matter what the emotional state is, that area is going to be the same. This is jargon, but it does require still that the wave packet, the ion motion, be smaller than a wavelength. So you can't be incredibly hot. But you don't have to be in a pure state of motion. That's kind of neat. Even though you're using the Coulomb interaction, you don't have to be in a pure state. These phase gates actually are what 90% of those algorithms and all the multi-qubit operations have been done in the community so far. Most of them have been this type of a gate. That was with one ion. With two ions, I won't get into too deep. You can make a phase gate this way. It's a ZZ type interaction. And this is the phase gate that NIST demonstrated in Dave Wineland's group in 2003 with a failure of 97%. And Innsbruck now has work in the mid-90% to 95%. Our group, we're stuck in the 80%. You can talk about the technical details why, but there's lots of other technical noise sources, and some are better than others at getting rid of them. Okay. So this is the type of a gate that looks very interesting regarding motion. Now, it's interesting that there's a, this is an interesting gate that's scalable in the sense that it can be also used to generate so-called cat states. It flips all pairs of spins. With that X Z squared interaction accompanied by a single bit rotations, you can make it work in an arbitrary number of ions. So instead of making just quantum circuits, you can make these massive entangled states to test decoherence. Yeah?
Is this 97% error still technical noise, or?
2% of this 3, there's 3% deficit here. 2/3 of that is from spontaneous emission from the excited state. Remember, early on I showed the lasers that are detuned? Well, they weren't detuned enough. When you detune further, things get slower, so you just need more power. If you go really far away, things get so slow that other noise sources come in. So it was kind of a happy balance. And that rest 1% was the other sources of noise, like magnetic field fluctuations and so forth. Well, that's what I want to talk about, magnetic field fluctuations. Because there's an asymmetry that's kind of interesting. The ZZ gate is very sensitive to magnetic fields. And the reason is ZZ gates only work on states that have a linear Zeeman shift. In other words, they don't work with Fock states. It's really too bad. And in fact, the NIST, tells you how great the NIST group worked on this. They got this fidelity with qubits that are not insensitive to magnetic field fluctuations. So that extra 1% is largely that. But there's this asymmetry between X and Z. I think we heard a little about that this morning. It's interesting that you can get around this by doing XX gates instead of ZZ gates. You can make XX gates work with Fock states. That was a little surprising at first glance. And so this seems to be the way to go. And an XX gate is very similar to a ZZ gate, just a different basis. It's a spin-dependent force that operates on up plus down versus up minus down. And to do that requires an extra few laser beams. There's some technical issues there. But at least you get rid of the phase noise from magnetic fields. Again, a better way of doing things. So I want the real subject here is how do we make this serious and scale up to truly large scale. And this I borrowed this slide from Dave Weiland, a few other slides too. And this is a little bit of a joke. Here are the ion trap electrodes here. This is really not a problem that the atoms are going to leak out the sides. We can always build the system bigger. The real problem, though, is that you have to deal with the collective mode of all these ions. Every time you add one, there's another mode, another three modes that come in, actually, right, from three dimensions. And it becomes a forest, and there's all the difference frequencies between any two modes. You have to be careful where they are. You're very much more sensitive to inharmonicities, things like that. So this is not the way to scale up. And very briefly, the way to scale up is to do operations with small numbers of ions in one zone, and then, like I said before, peel them off with quasi-static electric fields, classically, and just move them around. And that shouldn't come as a surprise that that would work, because remember, the qubit is stored in the spin, and we're operating with external forces via the electric field. So as long as you only use the motion in transit to make the gate, the motion is supposed to factor, and then you can pull the ion around. And there's a little slide that Ike Schwang lent me a while ago. I guess Andrew Cross is really responsible for this. And it's a simulation of. I think that you can. Andrew, you here?
No, he's not.
So it's a real sigmoid of, I think, a 9-bit code of error correction here. And there are realistic errors going on here. Now, these dots are clearly the ions that are moved around. The green ones and the red ones are the ones that carry quantum information. The blue ones are for sympathetic cooling. These are just refrigerators, right? And the idea is when you peel off, by the way, these little boundaries are electrodes. So by applying the right time-dependent electric fields, voltages on these electrodes, you can think of moving your information around this way and do error correction. The point is, though, you can see laser beams going on sometimes too. The point is all the quantum logic gates, the Serret-Zoller type gates, the ZZ gates or XX gates happen only when there's a couple of ions together, not 20 ions in one string. Okay? So this is a model that looks very interesting. Fiction right now. We don't know how to build exactly this device. I think we're making some progress along that road. But we don't have this yet. But this is the model that most of us in the community are looking at. And this is, in fact, the simplest version of that from Dave Weinman's group at NIST. It's a linear trap with several different zones, but only in one line. So he's done, Dave's group has done many 3 quantum bit operations by having two atoms trapped here very tightly with that tiny little electrode there, and then move one away over here, and then bring it in and do something else. They've been able to do all these protocols with that. In our group, we actually, this is a classical experiment, but we made a T-junction where the ion could actually turn corners, turn left or right, you can see this is a nightmare to wire together, lots of wires. And we're not really professional semiconductor fabricators or anything like that. So this is all done manually. You can see the size scale there. I mean, the screws actually give it away. Right? This is put together by hand. And all these connections in vacuum, very difficult to make work. And in fact, if you look closely at these different zones, this is gold that's just deposited on a ceramic. And if we look in this area here, this is I guess I showed a version of this video earlier. That's a single cadmium ion that was, after a couple of microseconds, shoveled around the corner to the left. Now, we actually did it with two different isotopes. We could distinguish them. And we were able to switch their positions by kind of doing a three-point turn, turn back like that. But this is a perimeter that you're going to need to do. And it turns out that, and again, there's some engineering here, but there's some very non-trivial things happening at this junction. It's very hard to make it a stable three-dimensional track at the junction. Careful thought there, and it took a while for that to work. And also, I'll note that a right turn, the right turn didn't work so well. I think we know why, but to make a right turn the way we did it is we made a left turn and then we came back down like that. And it had to do with the fact that there's three layers of electrodes here. Actually, you can't see it there. Maybe you can see underneath. There are three layers of these electrodes. They had to be aligned. They weren't aligned perfectly. They were aligned pretty well as you can do under a microscope. And you tighten down these screws, right, and hope that they don't move around. But the point is, the alignment really, there wasn't as much symmetry as you might imagine here. And that was our guess why the right turn was very difficult. And also, one thing I should point out is that this is not a quantum experiment. The only reason you see the ions is that they're being laser cooled, they're being measured, they're very cold. If we turn the light off up here, this ion has a lot of energy. I think it occupies almost a millimeter in real space. If we don't laser cool it, and eventually we're going to have to be able to do that while somehow quenching that motion, either with another species ion or doing adiabatically. We weren't really able to do that adiabatically in this trap. Yeah.
Just a technical question: what is the vertical spacing between your three your sandwich of electrons?
It's about a 1-to-1, so it's 200 microns. Okay, I need to move on. This is another version of a trap that at least it was integrated. If you look closely, you can see this is made of gallium arsenide, and we made two electrodes sticking out here. There's two layers here, but they're all perfectly aligned because this was done using the magic of mountains and microfabrication processes. So that wasn't the issue. The problem with this trap is, well, apart from being the worst apparatus I've ever dealt with, that was the problem, I guess. The problem is, I said before that these ions stay around for days, and some of our apparatus, they've stayed around for a week. Same ion stays, you go home, come back in the morning, still there, same one. This one, as long as you're laser cooling, it would stay for about 10 minutes. When you block the laser, it would stay for a tenth of a second. So there's a lot of heating boiling out of the trap. Maybe not a surprise, because this is a very small trap. At the time, it was the smallest trap. And so whatever this noise is, well, the environment's starting to creep in there, so you might expect the noise to grow. And so this is a compilation of many historical measurements over the last decade and a half or so. In different atoms, it shows the heating rate, if you want. This is energy per second, h bar omega times quantum per second is energy per second. And omega is about a megahertz. They're all about a megahertz. In any case, the x-axis here is the size of the track. So the bigger tracks have no problem. They can store emotional coherence for almost a second, these big tracks. But if they're big, you're not gonna be able to push two ions very close together to a gate. The gates were all done kind of down here, and here you can see is that chip track. It was much worse than we thought it would be even. And a smattering of data in beryllium. This is done at NIST. When I was at NIST, most of this data is taken. And this is our other work in some other tracks that are a little bigger. But you can see the general trend. We need to get small because we need to make this Schwann type, well, this type of a quantum CCD moving the ions around. We need to make these electrodes small, but we're going to run into this noise problem. So we actually went out to study this noise problem a little bit in a more controllable system. I mean, it's hard to compare. I mean, some of these are even in different countries. The different species, different countries, different electrode materials, different laboratories. It's amazing that actually there was somewhat of a trend here. Yeah.
How stable are these heating rates for a given trap? I mean,
they're stable over the course of weeks, not years, though. So if something happens to the surface, it might change chemically, or we don't really know. So part of the reason got us to thinking about this trap here, which is a double needle trap, and these needles are actually movable. So in the same apparatus, we were able to vary the spacing. That hadn't been done before. And again, our model of heating is that we have these little bad oxide layers or something, and they're moving around. This is not random. They're supposed to be random. And they're emitting electric fields. We know they're small because of the strong scaling with distance. But we don't really understand the source. It could be oxide layers. It could be contact potentials from an imperfect surface, so forth. But by moving the needle back and forth for the same ion trap, we can study this in a much better controlled system. And there's the data. And indeed, you know, we see that it's not quite warm to be before, as you might expect for tiny little patch potentials, that's what they're called. But it's very close, D minus 3.6, I think. More interestingly, when we cool the electrodes from room temperature down to about 150K, this heating rate went down dramatically. I mean, over here it went down almost 2 orders of magnitude. So there's some type of thermal activation process going on, almost certainly. So I think, even lately, measurements have gotten better. This is the same data actually plotted a little differently. Instead of plotting in terms of the vibration, the heating rate, we plot in terms of the noisy electric field. They're related. You get a couple through the charge, and there's a mass that pulls out. But these big red points are the points I just showed in the needle trap, and these are the cold ones at 150K. These are new measurements from Ike Shuang at MIT at 4 Kelvin. These are from NIST at room temperature in a very, very smooth gold electrode trap. We're going to get rid of this before we understand it. I'm convinced of that. So all we have to do is take that trap and cool it down to 4K, and it's not going to be a problem anymore. So actually, that problem I think is going to be gone. Except, you know, we're way here. Anyway, so we have our work. Personally, we have our work cut out for us. But I mean, for the community as a whole, this is great. I think
the size of those dots seems to be different. Is that uncertainty or?
No, I have two types of red dots here. I want.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, you know what that one is. That was the gallium arsenide trap. That one. Yeah. There's no significance to that. The uncertainty is probably factor 2 or 3 on all these measurements. Okay. Yeah.
What's this region, the Johnson noise? Is that something where?
Oh yeah. You know, it's hard to plot a single value here on all the tracks. It depends on geometry. It's black body radiation confined by the structure, so you have to. It's difficult to calculate. So I kind of left a little bit of a range. So this is kind of the worst case estimate for some of them. The Johnson noise is, you know, if you have a resistor at room temperature, it has fluctuating potential. That's another way to think about it. And these electrodes are not superconductors. They have finite resistance. So that's the fundamental source. Again, when that goes down to 4K, that's going to go down too. So 4K is in our future. Well, I have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about that. About 10 minutes left, right? Yeah. We started late. I want to talk about how to remotely do gates with these ions. It's not going to be through the Coulomb interaction. Well, I did point to a way you could do it based on the Coulomb interaction and then moving the ion around. But now we're going to talk about doing gates directly between ions that are stationary but very far apart. And it involves spontaneously emitted photons. And so this is going to be inspired by the measurement-based quantum computing models that you all know about, probabilistic gates and so forth. The idea here is, this is the atomic physics. Again, here's our inverted hydrogen atom. Spin 1/2 nucleus, spin 1/2 electron, we have these two hyperfine stages, our quantum bit. We zap this ion instead with a very fast laser pulse, a pulse that has bandwidth much bigger than this splitting here. And I'm thinking a bandwidth of maybe a terahertz or so, 1,000 gigahertz. So what it's going to do is going to couple both of these guys to these two states. Actually, due to the atomic selection rules, this red guy can only go there. The blue guy can only go there. So there's two disconnected two-level systems here, and that's what happens. The coherence should remain there. Now, it'll only remain there for a few nanoseconds, because the P state is radiatively unstable. It will decay after a few nanoseconds. So as long as this pulse is fast compared to a few nanoseconds, you're in good shape. So we do this with picosecond pulses, so we have a lot of room to spare. Now, what happens upon the emission of this photon? Eventually, the atom is going to radiate. in any of these four paths? Well, this is a probabilistic sort. So what we can do is throw away some of that spontaneous emission. If we only select light of a particular polarization, we actually come right back where we started. And that coherence should be intact. It should also be entangled with the color of that photon. The color is different by a part of 10 to the 5. That's 10 to the 10 hertz versus 10 to the 15 hertz. So you have actually a qubit in the photon encoded in its color. They're resolvable. Now, this is, of course, post-selected in the same sense that down-converted photons, you don't know they're entangled until you have destroyed them. And you can say, well, they were entangled. Same idea here. Well, at least one of them is a real spin. But the other one, to say you have entangled, you have to actually destroy the photon. And this has been done several years ago. We did this with a single atom and a single ion and actually with polarization to the photon. You can do it with frequency as well. Now, here's the experiment that where we have a single atom, in this case, ytterbium, because it has a friendlier wavelength that we can use optical fibers for. Only I showed that cadmium is in a deep, deep UV, very difficult to get optics for that. This is a little more friendly, it's still UV, but we can get good quartz fiber that will support that stuff. So this is a single atom emitter, and it's an isotope 174, which just means it has no nuclear spin. It's not a qubit, it's just an emitter. You zap it with a laser pulse, it emits a photon, period. There's no entanglement, there's no spin. So these photons come out, and this experiment simply showed that we have single photons. Well, of course we have single photons, we only have a single atom. And this is a picosecond pulse, so after a couple of picoseconds, you have an excited atom, there's no light anywhere else, so you're going to get one photon. You can't get more than one photon. And this is a standard type of a data showing that you have single photons. And what this is the coincidence counts on two photodetectors following a beam splitter. If you have a single photon, clearly you can't go to both. Only goes to one or the other. So you don't see any coincidence then. But you do see coincidence, say, 124 nanoseconds later, because that's the next pulse. So you could have had a coincidence, you could have had a photon hit here, and then 124 nanoseconds later, another photon goes that way, such that peak hits. So these peaks basically show adjacent pulses. But there's a clear null right here at zero. There's nothing there. And that's the figure of merit for single photon sources, and this is among the best, actually, because we have a single emitter. In free space, there's no other background light and so forth. There are dark counts, and that's why we jump all the way to zero, but there is no spike remaining here. Now, we want to double this experiment. We want to put something in this back side of the beam splitter. In fact, another ion emitter. And we're going to take advantage of a neat effect in quantum optics called the Hong-Liu-Mandel interferometer. And what this says is that if you have exactly two photons, mode matched on a beam splitter, they will always go out the same path. And if you look at the four possibilities of two photons in and two photons out, you have, so the beam splitter here is that diagonal, and the input ports from the left and from the bottom, they can both go to the right, they can both go up, they can both go through, they can both reflect. And it turns out, you can look at it in many ways, because you're going from a low index to a high index material, you get a phase shift on just one of these. So actually, these two paths interfere destructively. So you never get these. And this is what I just said. You never get the photons going in two different paths. They always go together. That's a pure quantum effect. It's been seen in many systems from the early days. Len Mandel at Rochester and his group showed it, and it was down-converted photons. It's been shown in quantum dots, neutral atoms, atomic ensembles, single neutral atoms, and we're kind of adding to the heat single ion. And again, the significance of the charged ion is that has all the advantage of an atomic system, only the atom is staying there all day, unlike the other atomic system here. So here's the data for two emitters. Again, no qubit yet. There's two emitters, and they're being repeatedly synchronously excited by this ultrafast laser pair. And they're mode matched. In fact, you have to have optical fibers for this step to mode match well. We tried it for about a year in free space, and it didn't work. Once this is mode matched, again, you can see that you get no coincidence at zero time delay. The photons never go in opposite paths, or very rarely. That residual peak there has to do with the imperfect mode matching. It's a few percent. Okay, now all we need to do is change the experiment over to an atom with hyperfine structure with spin. Here's a picture of the experiment, two separate ion traps about a meter apart, and there's a fiber coming out from each ion trap going into the going through the black box. It's really black here. And so now all we need to do is do the same experiment, but now you can see the key difference. This is 171, has an extra odd nuclear spin, so therefore, odd isotope number, therefore you have nuclear spin. Now you have a quantum bit. And the interesting thing here, many of you know this, some of you may not have seen this before, though. We have two separate systems, not entangled. Each one will be entangled with the color of the photon, as I showed before. Individually, they'll be entangled with the color of the photon. But now what happens if they're mode matched on the beam splitter? Well, clearly you'll never see down-down, because that meant you had a blue-blue photon. The blue-blue photon, you can only have two photons going there or there. You can never have two blue photons going in opposite detectors. Same with red-red. So you're actually going to project out the odd parity states, up, down, and down, up. In fact, you can show you're going to project out a singlet. So what happens is when you detect coincidence here, now you're able to detect coincidence because you've got two modes of the photon. When you detect coincidence, you've entangled the spins. So this is not post-selected. It's heralded. So, again, everybody here, I think, knows that terminology. And furthermore, I've never talked about the Coulomb interaction or motion. Motion plays zero role here. So this is a big advantage of this type of scheme. It's also, it looks like an interferometer. It is, but it's not so sensitive to the positioning, turns out. That's kind of a technical point. And this is data taken with a couple of these terbium ions. And we wait until we get double clicks, and then we diagnose the spin. We look at the spin. What are the states? And again, we can measure this with near-perfect detection efficiency. So the data includes imperfect detection efficiency of about 1 or 2% here. You can see, by and large, we do get the states we expect. There are some dark counts, though, in the other states. Sometimes we get mistaken dark counts from imperfect PMTs, not much from background light, mostly from the bad PMTs. Now, if that doesn't show entanglement by itself, we have to measure in a different basis and using standard tricks. Well, we have two atoms here separated by a meter. We can flip each of them individually and then do the same type of measurement, and we see a fringe here. The contrast of that fringe, along with these measurements, can put bounds on the entanglement. Basically, what we've done is we've measured these components of the density matrix, and we can put limits on the entanglement. And, it's barely entangled, but it's entangled enough. And the reason it's barely entangled is the bad news. And it has to do with really these bad points here. And the fact that this contrast isn't perfect. It has to do with the fact that the experiment almost never works. Now, you may have noticed, I didn't kind of zoom through it. Some of you may have noticed that number up there. So every time we zap these two spins, you have a snowball's chance in hell of actually seeing it. So you have to repeat the experiment really fast. In fact, the bad news is it's about 10 to the minus 8 or 10 to the minus 9 is the probability. Fortunately, we can do the experiment at about a megahertz. So we can do it pretty fast. But we still have to wait about 10 minutes for each double click. So that's pretty horrible. And I think in the long run, the good news is we know how to, I think, fix this to a certain extent. I think we can push this up to about 1 hertz. And then I think that will probably happen soon. And then things start to get interesting. When you push it up to 1 hertz, dark counts go away. So the fidelity is actually going to grow too. So this is, I think, an interesting avenue to pursue. Now, I want to say there's more, because that paid entanglement, we can also do remote gates. And again, I'm running out of time. I'm not going to talk about it too much. But it's a very simple extension of what we've already done. We can store quantum information in these qubits and then do the same experiment. It turns out you can have a probabilistic ZZ gate here. And this is sufficient to make cluster states and so forth. And I know people here have thought a lot about these. I'm going to skip really fast to the end, which is a good thing. I don't have the background to really talk about how errors are going to be important in these types of geometries. For instance, I know Robert here and Robert Elsendorf, Kriegel, Lumi Guan, and others have really thought about how to make this scalable using pure probabilistic gates. Unlike the work in atomic ensembles, this is actually a scalable system. And now the scaling, again, Robert and Luming showed a few years ago, if P is 10 to the minus 9, well, you can look at that through math. You have to, it's a huge overhead. But this is just, you know, it's a simple bound, and I think work on that is really improving. Not to mention that the assumptions of this bound are that all the other operations are perfect, measurements are perfect, and so forth. So I think it's really an open question how far we can push this. And I understand, I should point later at Michael, I understand you've done some very recently that made some amazing improvements on this type of a model, this type of a model of cluster state quantum computing in terms of what the error thresholds are for fault tolerance. So I'm not going to show the concept, but the idea is if you want to put atoms that are fixed really far apart, that's how you entangle them. There's a type of beam splitter and so forth. So you can imagine having some professionals make this on a chip with these micromirror arrays, and you can steer them differently to entangle any pair you want on different parts of that CCD. So I think there's a lot of technology this is begging for, and some folks are actually interested in doing this. So with that, I'll conclude, and I'll also note that I'm right now in a supercondition state between Michigan and the University of Maryland. I'll be there in a few months. A new joint quantum institute between the university and IST. And this is the group in Michigan. About half of them a third of them are graduating and leaving. A third of them are coming with me, half are coming with, and a few are staying behind. Trying to keep track of it. But thanks for your attention.
You talk a lot about noise sources through your whole talk, and the language you use is very different than the theorists talking about fault tolerance. How are you going to recognize, you know, whether or not you're sort of in the right regime dealing with fault tolerance potential?
I guess the easy answer is that we're so far away from any of the things.
The next 5 years, whatever, goes very well, and you start thinking.
Well, I think we're going to be measuring, doing process tomography on these gates, and measuring which parts of the, I did talk about noise very generically, saying T1, T2 are the same thing for us. But you're absolutely right. When we push the next 9 or 2, hopefully in the next several years, we're going to have to start to talk about what the blockster is really doing. And that's not a very good answer because I really don't know. There are these asymmetric noise sources. They depend on, I think as mentioned earlier, Z and X noise are quite different. Z noise is much worse. We don't see spin split noise. There's colored noise on all the classical knobs we have. And whenever you have one of ref noise on something, it's very, very difficult to model how that propagates through the system. And that's particularly true of this heating noise. You saw the one over ref to the one over d to the fourth, but it's also, as you make the traffic weaker, that noise goes through as well. I didn't answer your question pretty much at all. It's just that I have no idea, but we are going to have a much better
knowledge of this. To some extent, does the process but I think even that is potentially a problem, which is it relies on having reliable learners. In order to do process tomography and determine you have 96% fidelity is okay at the moment, but the process fidelity of 99.9% fidelity actually is very hard because the diagnostic tool that you use.
Yeah, they're also.
You need something to fault tolerance process tomography to see. Anyway. Are there other questions?
Sort of an experimentalist question. So you showed the probability of success for the coincidence counting was this multiplication of a whole bunch of factors less than one, one of which is the solid angle. So the one way to go around that is by saying, well, I'll go to 4π microscopy techniques, put two large numerical apertures, but then that tells you that you can't really integrate, you don't need to integrate these traps, or you can't integrate these traps at high density because you have these large objectives. So has anyone looked at what kind of architecture you would think about using, given the limits
and
probability of success from numerical aperture?
Let me make a guess, and I'll be very optimistic here, of course, but this is a solid angle, it's 2%. We're only capturing 2% of the light from 2% of the light from each ion. Now, if we could make that 10%, and that could be done by taking a fiber tip and bringing it really close, you probably want to metallize it so that it doesn't charge up, affect the ion. But I think maybe if we can get 10% on that, that's a factor of 5 squared, which is not a big deal. But if you can couple it directly to a fiber, this number goes away. Because it turns out this 20% coupling from each ion to the fiber is due to the fact that the mode, this is a solid angle, but this is actually includes what we collect into our fiber. That has to do with the fact that the mode of the radiation pattern is not a Gaussian mode. It doesn't match the mode of the fiber. So if we can actually integrate those two, we can get 10% here. That's a factor of 25. And that's another factor of 25. That's a factor of 600 overall in this. That'll get us to about a hertz, actually, just that. Now, there are other issues. We have just simple PMTs. We could probably bring that up to the 70 or 80% range. There's some superconducting edge detectors that can get almost arbitrarily high. That would be another factor of 5 squared. Well, it's easy to talk about factors of 5 squared. This is a technical thing. We can get rid of that. It's a factor of 4. It has to simply do with the fact that our laser pulses are, I don't want to get into that. It's very easy to get rid of that one. Losses, I'm going to leave that there. There are always going to be some losses. But I think 1 hertz is, as I said before, I think that's likely. Now, to get this up to 100%, I think you want to put a cavity around the ion. Maybe that was what you were hinting at.
Well, yeah. Cavity, or if you're talking about collection, you could put 2, there's a 4-pi microscopy techniques where you put 2 numerical.
Cavity doesn't have to be 4-pi. If you put that single ion between a fabric throw like this, it's going to radiate in that mode preferentially compared to in free space. So it doesn't have to be such a close geometry. And you can get almost all the light to go into this cavity, and you can make this maybe 99.999% reflecting, and that's 100%.
But you have electrodes there that presumably spoil the cube.
Yeah, the electrodes, again, they don't have to be small. They can be, this motion plays no role here. We don't need really tight binding. So yeah, we're looking at having, say, a 0.5 millimeter cavity and a 2 millimeter trap. But yeah, a lot of improvements on all these numbers can happen. Yeah.
So is this time limit, the long range time limit, possible to combine that with the idea of moving ions around for nearby gates, or is it?
Yeah, in fact, I just kind of skipped over that. I'm down at the bottom here. In fact, Luming and I proposed this a few years ago of doing not necessarily moving ions around, but using the Coulomb interaction at short range to entangle these guys, and then doing this probabilistic gate between the remote ions. And that by itself, you can show it's scalable without making cluster states. And then Luming and Robert and others showed that, well, you don't even need Coulomb interaction. You can make cluster states in general with neutrals or quantum dots or anything.
Okay, if there are no further questions, let's get started.